session number 12673, and this is Reel 3.
Mr. Hill, Reel 3. So, how many weeks were you doing these recce patrols for?
We, I suppose, well, 3 months, I suppose, we were doing it. April, May, June, July. Yeah, about July. And then my battalion was was brought out of the front line then for more or less a rest. You had a period of rest. Another battalion took your positions over.
How much do you think these recce patrols achieved?
Well, in my opinion, not a lot, because you see, you got to realise that we were foreign troops in that country, whereas the Chinese, that was their terrain, and they could really camouflage themselves. I can remember seeing the American Air Force absolutely obliterate top of a hill with napalm bombs, and the artillery shell that hill till virtually the hill was flattened. But still the Chinese survived, because they used to dig themselves right down in tunnels. And that's where the Americans, especially the Americans, lost a lot of troops, because they used to think that they softened the Chinese up. And when they, especially on where you've heard of Heartbreak Ridge, where they virtually blew the top of the hill off, thinking they killed every Chinaman up there. And when they started to go up the hill, there was a full complement welcoming them party waiting for them up there. They hadn't made no impression at all on them.
Did you ever lose any troops killed or wounded on the...
Yeah, yes. We lost two or three that came across a Chinese patrol. I'm trying to think where they came. One came from Taunton in Somerset. He was a mate of mine. I did know him. There was another lad. He got killed. He was a Londoner.
How did these casualties occur? Did you see them?
I saw the body of this youngster from Taunton. He'd have got shot in the chest, which he was buried for full military honours in Seoul, which I could sort of annoyed, actually. Might sort of go off the subject, but it was it in my mind at the time. In the Gulf War, not the Gulf War, correction, in the Falklands, they brought most of the bodies back. I know, because I was at Marchwood Military, the course of my job then, and saw them come in. They were all in containers. They were all brought back for private burial and God knows what. But the youngsters that were, this is my point, they were regular soldiers. And I've got every admiration for them, because they joined the army, but they were professional soldiers. They joined the army and they were told that they were trained to fight. We weren't. We were a young national serviceman. We didn't even know what it was about. And they never got any bodies back from Korea. And it always hurt me, you know, you take the mother of these two that I know. They don't know where their sons are buried. They're buried in the war cemetery in Seoul. But what chance have they got to go and see them? They may have done, I mean, years later. But always annoyed me to think they brought all the bodies back from the Falklands, and yet they didn't bring anybody back from Korea.
How did your work with the radio set go? Did that go smoothly, or was it difficult?
No, very with great difficulty, I'm afraid. Every day we had a different code sign, and the only one that I can remember was Birdcage. We were always Birdcage 1 able, because we were able company. And the conflicting messages that we received, you were more or less in contact with your company headquarters all the time. He was directing you to where he wanted you to go, and you were always alongside your company commander because you were his radio operator. And you used to just relay messages to him from the command position, and he used to give you messages to send back. But there was so much electricity and, you know, sort of interference that you had, because the terrain of Korea, I don't know where you ever realized, it's very hilly and mountainous, and you had to get in good positions to get any reception at all. And another disadvantage of being a radio operator was that you had your earphones on all the time, so consequently you could only hear what was coming through your headset. You didn't know what the hell was going on, and you know, you'd be walking along and you suddenly look and all your colleagues had laid down, because gunfire, you couldn't hear that. You were always the last to come down. Many times the officer used to push you down. And I remember the particular company commander that we had, he always used to carry my rifle, and I used to carry his 45. Always thought I was Buck Jones or something. I had the 40, which a 45 automatic was virtually useless. I mean, any other range of about a few yards, whereas the old 303, the Enfield, he always felt safer with my rifle, but I had the pleasure of carrying his 45. I always remember at the end of the day, so give me my officer, my revolver back, soldier, and you have, here's your rifle back. And he used to give me a bike, and the rifle's very dirty or something like that, you know. But the morale was quite good, really, because out there, I found that soldiering out in a war zone was far better than soldiering in England or in Germany, because the officers, you, even the commanding officer, was in the same boat. You were against the enemy. In fact, the officers always used to take their flashes off in case they were captured. They looked just like us. You knew who they were, but if they were ever captured, then obviously they were an because if the Chinese knew they were officers, well, then they would give them interrogation like hell. And the sort of things I can remember. I remember in one other incident, I think it's about anyone I can remember offhand, Sergeant Lahine, this sergeant again, he figured that we were being infiltrated by Chinese troops at night. In other words, they were getting into our positions at the bottom of the hill, because he found evidence that there was troops that had cut through the barbed wire during the night. They hadn't crawled up to our positions, but he was most concerned. So I always remember this bloke's name, Wilf Senior, Private Wilf Senior. He was a Geordie, and he was a crack shot with a Bren gun. So this particular incident, with the permission of the officer, Sergeant Lahine said that he wanted Will Senior right on top of this hill. He would go down with two other soldiers, volunteers, you and you. That was the, I mean, you didn't volunteer, we just said, I want two volunteers, you and you, which wasn't me, fortunately, because I was a radio operator. And they were going to go down into the valley to see if there was any Chinese that come through at the night. And on the word of command, with a flashlight, I remember this, Wilf Sr. was supposed to open up with his brain gun. Well, it was a quiet night. They all went off. It was very peaceful. All of a sudden, we heard this brain gun start. It was Wilf Sr. I suppose he let off about 5 magazines. Just fired down this hill. The next morning, Sergeant Lehane came up. He was splattered in mud, and so was the other two soldiers. And I said, "Do we see anything during the night, Sarge?" "No," he said. "I want to have a word with Private Senior." He said, "Whoever told you you were a crack shot?" He said, "Because," he said, "you were firing right into a mud bank, and not one bullet ever got near where I wanted you to fire." And it was a laugh, I mean, but it was an incident. I mean, we just pulled the trigger, like, you know, hoping that he was killing thousands and thousands of Chinese. And as I say, it was a sort of incidents like that that comes across your mind.
Had there been Chinese down there?
Yeah, because they used to leave messages. They used to leave leaflets saying, "Why are you fighting out here? You know, why don't you go back to your own country? Your country's not in conflict with the Chinese," and things that we used to, in good, you know, written English. It was more or less propaganda. They couldn't understand. "Why don't you give yourself up? You know, you'll be well treated, and we'll promise you to get you back to the White Cliffs of Dover," and all things like anything to try to break your morale. Or "Do you know that the biggest army in the world is about to attack you," and all that sort of thing. Anything to sort of, "And why don't you come and join the communist and learn about the communist ideals," and all things like that. Like, they'd do anything, you know.
What effect do you think these leaflets had? What effect?
Not. The lads that I were, not a bit. We used to laugh at it because, as I say, as the months went by in Korea, you really got hard, and you were really hard cases. You got over your a juvenile sort of state. You were actually really soldiers then. Though you were still national service, you could compare yourself with a regular soldier because you learned the hard way. In fact, towards the end, there was hardly any distinction between a regular soldier and a national serviceman because you just blended in together.
So did you take a pride in your soldiering?
I always considered that it was very proud to have served in the glorious Gloucesters, because that's what they were called. Yeah, I was proud to think that. I mean, if I don't do anything else in my life, at least I've seen something. But once again, I still resented the fact that, why was I there? Why was men or youngsters my age? Why were we there?
This is what I was wondering, because you told me earlier that you had that point of view about why you should be there at all. And you said the Chinese were saying this in their leaflets.
That's right.
That you shouldn't, that you didn't have any quarrel with them or something. And yet you said that the leaflets were ineffective.
No, because what I'm trying to say is, at the time you were out there, this reflection that I had was afterwards, because I thought myself, I could have lost my life out there. And like everything else, when you're actually there, you've got one thought on your mind: survival for yourself, and hope to hell you can soon get out of it. You had these reflections afterwards because we were virtually treated, after we came out of Korea, as film stars. We were the glorious Gloucesters. I mean, the trip home was like a luxury cruise to us. I mean, and when we came into Southampton, there's the ship I came home on, up there, the Empire Foey. I mean, all right, you didn't have the television that you had, but we had the newsreel, we had fireworks, we had welcome out. Our heads were like that.
Swelling.
We were, you know, when people come up and ask you for your autograph, I mean, when you think of it now, it's so stupid. But at the time, you were just bomb happy. You were home, or you were coming home. It was after you sort of, you know, sat back and you got older, and more wiser. You thought, well, what the hell was I doing out there? You were, because you were under the auspices of the United Nations, and the government of the day decided that all right, they would send troops to the Korean Theater of War, and I happened to be one of them. I mean, if this country was threatened, yeah, I suppose we'd all be patriotic and want to fight. But there was no, I mean, after people in this country never knew there was a war in Korea.
But did you feel that the national servicemen were as good as the regular?
I certainly do, sir. I certainly do. especially what I was in, because we were all thrown together. So, all right, the old soldiers knew some of the tricks. I mean, they were crafty. I mean, they con you out of your equipment. You know, they con you out of this. But then after a while, you learnt their con tricks, and you were doing it for the other blokes that was coming in after. So it was a combination, you know, a vicious circle. You were greenhorns when you first arrived, and afterwards you were really hard-baked soldiers.
But were the national servicemen more likely to fall casualty in the fighting than the regulars because they were greener?
That's a very job, our job, a question to answer. No, I wouldn't think so, because I think when you're in a situation, as we were, you learn very quickly. And what I did find, that we did have first-rate NCOs and officers who I don't think they would put you at risk. It was like everything else. I mean, if you suddenly was in a patrol and you walked right in front of a machine gun nest, well then, no matter how experienced you were going to get hit the same as whether you weren't experienced. I've got every admiration for the officers and the NCOs that were in Korea. They weren't national servicemen. They were regular soldiers. And, I mean, this Sergeant Lehane always told us that if we saw him run, we run after him. In other words, when he saw danger, and he made a decision, we act with him. And actually, he got us out.
Did that ever happen where he did run?
No, not actually run. That was a figure I'm talking about. He would never put himself in a position which he thought that we couldn't accommodate. I mean, the only time that I think that the time that I really thought that the end of the world had come is when on one particular occasion the officer gave us the order to fix bayonets. Now, fortunately, we never had to go into a bayonet charge, because I don't know, I can't be honest whether I could have done it or not. I mean, you're talking about, you really come face to face with your enemy, you only had a bayonet 6 inches long. And I thought, oh, you know, you see it in the movies where a fixed bayonet's in charge. Don't believe it. It's a nerve-wracking experience. We didn't have to go into a bayonet charge, but the order was given. And I thought, well, this is the end of it. I mean, you just imagine charging down a hillside with fixed bayonets. I mean, it means to say you've run out of bullets. Whether or not it was a little bit of bravado on the officer or not, but fortunately the order was reversed soon after. But at that moment I thought, well, it's the end of me, goodbye. And that's when you felt like running the other way.
Now, you said that after about 3 months, in July 1951, you were pulled out of the front line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happened to you then? Did you go to Seoul?
We went back to Seoul, the Americans call it R&R, don't they? Rest and Rehabilitation. We were more or less put up in a camp where it was more luxurious than what it was in the front line. For a start, you could the most thing that we enjoyed was having a shower every day and having clean clothes and more or less decent food to eat. Well, you more or less just enjoyed yourself. They used to put on shows. I mean, I saw Danny Kaye put a show on, like, ain't there any American, there was no British stars. I never saw any British stars, but any American stars that happened to be there at the time that you were there, obviously you were invited to see. All free of charge, of course.
What was Seoul like? What condition was it in? Devastated?
Well, Seoul had changed hands several times. I mean, one period the Chinese had captured it, and then the Americans had recaptured it. But finally, it was held. The war sort of moved north of Seoul. So therefore, it was more or less a safe area to be in the time that we got there. It was devastated because, I mean, there had been shelling. It wasn't much. I mean, first time I saw Seoul afterwards was when they had the Olympic Games there. Well, of course, it's a modernized city now, but it wasn't much of a city when I was there.
Were you allowed to have anything to do with the civilians? Were you able to speak to any? Or?
Oh, well, yeah, you could speak to them. I mean, we had a common name for them, which probably wouldn't embrace the Race Relations Act, but we used to call them gooks. They all seemed to have one name, Kim. Everybody was named Kim, Sung, Kim Sung, or Kim Sung something else. We didn't have a lot to do with it. They were the most actual Koreans that I come in contact with were more or less peasants in the villages, and they really didn't know who the enemy was. They were illiterate, half of them. They didn't know if we could have been their enemy. We were there more or less to protect them. I mean, I don't know if you know what this Korean War was about. It was the North Koreans were communists, the South Koreans were run by the Americans, and the communists decided to attack South Korea, and that's where the war started. So virtually they didn't really know who they, you know, was. They knew that, I suppose, that I remember we used to go on patrols, and another incident, we were on this particular patrol and we could see a load of refugees, peasants, coming towards us, and we had a lot of intelligence officers. They got in amongst these peasants, and we didn't know. We were just more or less on the roadside watching them. All of a sudden, they pulled two or three Chinese out and stood them up against the lorry, and we found out that they were Chinese troops mingling in with the peasants and the refugees, rather, and we said to, you know, one of the agent, no, he said, well, you tell them they got a European haircut, their nails had been manicured, peasants wouldn't have that, and that's the sort of things that they picked a mate for.
So these were Koreans themselves? Who?
No, they were Chinese, because you couldn't.
No, but the people who spotted them were Korean.
No, they were American and British intelligence officers. You see, you had a Republican of Korea, South Korea Army. We used to call them the Rocks, but they weren't a lot of good. I didn't have a lot of. Nobody had a lot of faith in them.
Why not?
Well, they seemed to give up. They could never. Though it was their country, they seemed to give up the fight. They gave up the fight. That more or less is why the United Nations had to come in. Against the North Koreans, because when I first got to Korea, the enemy was North Korea. But General MacArthur went against President Truman's wishes and wanted the bomb across the Yellow River, if you remember. I mean, probably you're too young to remember. Well, that actually brought the Chinese into the war. Well, virtually then, it was the Chinese against the United Nations. I mean, the Chinese used to, I mean, we're talking about 85,000 troops that they poured into Korea. Numbers was no problem to them. So virtually, the war changed. You were fighting the Chinese communists. So that the North Koreans and the South Koreans virtually took a sideline view then, because it was the Americans mostly. I mean, Americans had supplied most of the troops. They applied most of the equipment. In fact, in the finish, it was the Americans that fed us. We had to rely on their food. They used to supply us with food.
You changed from British food to American food?
Yeah, because we used to go on their, what they call their K rations, and that was used to be some, to us, it was luxurious to what we used to get. I mean, bully beef and all that. I mean, you eat, sleep and drink that, whereas the Americans used to have ice cream in that, some of their stuff, if you could get it. And I always will say this, that the Americans were very good to us. I got nothing against the Americans that were in Korea. Obviously, they were better fed, better paid than what a British soldier was, but they used to share a lot of their stuff. If we ever come across an American combat unit, we used to do very well out of them. You know, the cigarettes, whatever you wanted, they had.
Did they show any interest in the things that you had to offer? Like,
not a thing. We had nothing to offer.
So they weren't interested in your bullets.
The only thing that they were interested in was the Gloucesters had two badges, one in the front and one in the back, and they used to. They did in the finish. They used to first of all ask us if we could have our back. We used to say no, we can't. We're getting in trouble. So in the finish, they resorted in nicking them for souvenirs. But I mean, it was all in the finish. Some of our lads used to make a profit. We'll give you our hat badges if you'll give us something else. And you know, it was a bartering sort of a situation.
How long did you have the rest and recreation in Seoul?
You had 21 days. I always remember, I had 21 days. That was more or less 3 weeks. And then you weren't back to your position. Obviously, your positions might have changed that where you went to after you'd been more or less on leave. But in my instance, it was near enough the same sort of area we were in. It might have been a different valley, but it was still in the same sort of circumference of where you were all the
near
time.
The engine.
And I remember this was coming to the end of my Korean experience, because I remember Colonel Digby Crist, he was the man that took over from Karn. He paid us a visit one day, and a lot of the lads was writing letters, like home. And he came up to several of us and he said, are you writing home? So, yes, sir, we're writing home. Well, who are you writing to? Well, I'm writing to my mother and my wife. None of us was married. We was only youngsters. Well, you can put in there as a P.S. that you'll be home for Christmas. And, oh, that was one, you know, that was news that we never... We're going home. The battalion is going home. We've done our tour of duty.